This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Laws of Our Fathers. Written by Scott Turow. Read by James Snyder, Orla Cassidy, Dion Graham, and Kevin T. Collins.
Part 1. Accusation. Those of us born in the years of bounty after World War II knew we had a different outlook than earlier generations of Americans. Blinkered by need, they had come of age with narrower commitments to the glory of God, the glee of acquisition, or the mean little business of survival. But we took seriously the promise of the Declaration of Independence, that the birthright of America was not merely life or liberty, but the pursuit of happiness. Personally, as a child, I always assumed that was the point of growing up, so I'd feel better than I did then. Which leaves us with the awful, doomed inquiry of our middle years, the harpy's voice that whispers in dreams, at sunrise, at those unforeseen instants of drilling isolation. Is this as happy as I will ever be? Do I have the right to just a little more? Or is there nothing better I should hope for? Michael Frayn, The Survivor's Guide, September 7th, 1995.
September 7th, 1995. Hardcore. Dawn. The air is brackish, although this place is miles from water. The four high-rise towers hulk amid a hardened landscape of brick, of tar and pavement broken by weeds, of crushed Coke cups and candy wrappers, of fly-about newspaper pages. A silvery bedding of broken glass, the remnants of smashed bottles, glitters prettily. One more false promise. It is a time of uncommon quiet. In the night, there are often sounds of life at the extreme. Outcries and drunken yells. Machines at volume. Sometimes gunfire. The day brings voices. Children. The many standabouts. The species at large. Now the wind is up, whistling in the fence links and on the bricks. At the prospect of motion, the man walking this way looks up abruptly. But there is only a dog huddled in a gap between the buildings who, out of some animal instinct, has determined, across the distance of 100 yards, to have no truck with him. A single used tire sits, inexplicably, on the cracked blacktop of the play yard. The man, Ordell, is almost 36 years old. He still maintains some of his penitentiary build, buffed up, he'd say, although he's been out again 4 years now. He is dressed simply, black shirt and trousers. No gold. Don't wear you no gold when you working, he often advises the unborns, the 8 and 9 and 10-year-old wannabes who trail after him, complimenting his appearance and offering to do him favors when he arrives here most afternoons. Hardcore, they always going. Get you Coca-Cola by Korea? Like he don't know they aiming to keep the change. This morning, Ordell Trent, gang name Hardcore, is alone. The building he approaches, the tallest of the four which comprise the Grace Street projects, has come over the years to be called by everyone the IV Tower, due supposedly to the Roman numerals, but most suspect the label originated with the familiar mockery of the residents practiced by the police, who refer to the building among themselves as the Ivory Tower. The open structures, windows, porches, connecting walkways, are caged in mesh of heavy gauge. Formerly, From the gangways and balconies, refuse was sometimes thrown. Bricks were tossed down on enemies, as in the Middle Ages. Drunks and dopeheads stumbled to their death, and several persons were pushed. Around three or four windows, you can see the ragged blackening marks of bygone fires, and at street level, on the bricks, in rounded letters, the initials of Ordell's gang have been inscribed in phosphorescent colors, etched in black. BSD, Black Saints Disciples. His set, the branch of the gang which Ordell heads, the T4 Rollers, is often celebrated too. And some daring members of Gangster Outlaws, a rival organization, have also put their marks here, wall banging, as it is known. Occasional messages of personal affirmation, quickly sprayed, appear now and then as well. D-Ron is cool. Lucifer. Inside, Ordell nods to security. Chuck, he named. Chump Rent-A-Cop from Kendall County Housing Authority, huddled in a concrete shelter with a small window of bulletproof glass. Chuck getting half of one, $50, every month from Ordell. And Chuck, he like to love hardcore, man. See him? Chuck damn well salute. In the entry, the sole illumination is from a Pepsi machine with a heavy padlock. Every electrical fixture is gone, stolen to sell, or put out by some saint who prefers to do business in the dark. Bare wires and twisted bunches snake from the walls. The atmosphere is sodden with the bitter reek of hallway filth and broken plumbing. The paint is old. The pipes, exposed overhead, have grown rust stains and mold. The impression is of a bunker, something built to survive the bomb. The floor is concrete. The walls are cinder block. Everything is marked with gang signs. The Saints halo, the capped four, which represents the T4 Rollers, and names. D-Town, Michael Might, Babyface, Priest. Written in school markers, or more often, smoked into the plasterboard or paint with a cigarette lighter. The elevator, one of them, is working again today. And hardcore rise to 17. The first five floors of this building are more or less deserted now, given up by folks who found even $38.50 a month too high a price for a life where beds had to be placed on the floors to avoid the gunfire, where the safest sleeping was in the bathtub. When he lets himself in, hardcore hears the old woman's husky breath, clotted by the deteriorations of living, emerging from one of the two back rooms he lets her have. Ordell has the two front rooms, where he watches. From up here, he can see the entire operation. Sometimes the police, tic-tac, as the Saints call the Kendall County Municipal Police Force Tactical Unit, the ones who won't accept hardcore's money, and a few who do, sit down there and watch. They're wondering, he knows. How come this nigga's so cool? How come it frees up whenever they on the scene? Because Ordell sees from here. He got all them tiny gangsters, the youngest gang members, peepers as they called, roving, scoping. Any police, any rent-a-cop, any limp DEA, any of them mothers trucking to them towers, hardcore gon' know. On the street, that cuts a perpendicular. There are 2-3 flats and some tiny gangsters down there on the steps each day servicing the cars that pull up. They got rock, bottles, crank, sometime pills. Some top-ranked gangsters, veterans, and BSD, they all slang a couple zones, sell a couple ounces to their homies every week, be tight, all they need. Not Ordell. He got him houses and ladies. He got a blazer and a slick BMW 755. Shit, he got his gold. But what be fat and all is this thing, what he got going here. DJs, so-called, to mix the stuff, and scramblers who get paid in drugs to make the connections. Mules to carry it and move it 2 times every day from the garages and apartments where it's stored, and his artillery. Ancho, Gorgo and them. Armed motherfuckers so nobody think they can move up on Ordell. 75 people, sometime 100, and hardcore watching over. Go here, mother. Go there. Don't get beat by no snitch. Don't deal with no narc. Don't mess with no rings or gold, see? Cash, man, do it. That's what he wants. Something happening, man, every day. Now, slightly past 6, his beeper alerts, vibrating at his hip. Hardcore curses aloud when he inspects the readout. Now, more whining. Too late for that shit, he knows to himself. At his voice, the old woman's rasping breath briefly ceases. Perhaps she is awake now, listening, pressing at her gray hair, snuffling and clearing her throat in hopes he'll leave. Here in the front room, there is nothing. 2 chairs, old newspapers. The concrete floor holds the sallow glimmer of the early light. The rug was stolen long ago. This was her apartment. Raised her children here. The boy in Rudyard, 2 boys, Ordell thinks, and some bitch, a silly pipehead selling what she can out on the street. In the pen, the boys come to Jesus and busted out, quit BSD. So Ordell set moved in here. The old woman was tough. You all gone, shoot and kill me, do whatever you all like, I ain't moving out. This here's my house, I ain't giving my house no bunch of silly ass hoodlums. T-Rock, one of BSD's 2 heads, vice lord he called. T-Rock told Hardcore straight up,
do just like she say, man, fade her.
Hardcore, he put in work for his, done whatever for BSD, be a bar none sane and all, but he don't fall to capping no old lady. He decided to leave her stay. And I ain't gonna have no dope peddling a horn or any other gangbang or whatnot in here neither, she said to Ordell. We ain't doing nothing, he told her. She said. Now she sleeps. Just then, 6:15, like they've been saying, he sees the ride. Some shitbox Chevy, 100 years old, bend the corner on the street far below. Now, Ordell thinks, now we're gonna tear some shit up. He has field glasses, but he can see well enough. Bug, just folding the flip phone back into her jacket, approaches the car. Then she retreats a distance, as she's supposed to do. The cell phone in his pocket makes a throaty sound. Yo, he answers. Sup, cuz?
10-2,
Lavinia says. They use radio code, mix it up, make them tic-tacs crazy.
10-2.
Means trouble, need help.
You here?
She adds. That Lavinia don't never have no respect.
Stall out, bitch, I hear. And I don't see no damn 10-2.
On the broad avenue, on Gray Street, there is nothing. Cars, white folks driving by fast. Not even foot trade.
I ain't see nothing. You standing still, bitch, and you best be hitting the wall, man. Ain't to see, not from where you is, and I ain't talking on this punk-ass telephone neither. 10-2.
She's gone with that. Set up, he thinks, as he often thinks. Bug, as Lavinia is known. Damn, Bug be setting him up. Cannell, T-Rock, one of them. Maybe them goobers, as the Saints call the gangster outlaws. One of them switched it somehow. He ponders Cannell and T-Rock, Commandant and Vice Lord of BSD. They on top, man, but they all the time tripping and shit, worrying his hardcore on this power thing, man. He gonna bust his whole set right out the gang or what? And him running 8 zones into the jail every week. So BSD down for theirs. Catch his black booty, he be gone forever. Set him up. He grunts aloud at the thought of it. But he's on his way. He has a 9mm pistol stored behind the iron grating of the air return, and he tucks it in his belt and lets his black silk shirt hang out of his trousers. In the elevator, he continues rumbling with his angry thoughts, speaking to himself and wondering if he should have shouted out for Honcho, some of them. Scared, he thinks. Scared is what he is and old enough to know it. All them youngsters always putting down that shit. Can't no nigga fade me. Shit like that make him laugh. You always scared. Get used to it is all. Gotta be, it's gotta be. He has 3 sons. Dormain, Hardball he called. Got 2 kids of his own. He inside, doing 15, no parole and some fool by bust. And Rockleed is on these streets too. And a little one, Dell,
Still too young to know too much of nothing. Their mamas, each of them, behind Ordell's back, told those boys the same. Don't you be no dope peddler now. Don't you be slanging and hanging and banging. I'll be whomping you backside. You ain't never gonna be too big for me to do you like that. That's what they saying. In his own time, Ordell gave each of these boys his answer. You gotta be somebody. There's bad shit here, with them bad coppers, bad motherfuckers everywhere here. But man, he said, man, this here with you alls, you with the people here. You giving them what these poor niggas need, some nickels worth of happiness white folks and all don't want them having. Walking from the IV tower, the first stirrings of the day, music and voices from some windows. Wondering, is he really gonna get himself gauged? Hardcore thinks, as he often does, about his sons. He walks past one of the newer buildings, where the concrete corner is parted, revealing a cheap core of pink foam. In a nearby play area, only one seesaw remains, and on that, both seats were long ago shattered by some teen in a random outbreak of destructive will. A milky-eyed drunk is teetering down the block, slept it off somewhere, now looking for home. He has a tatty overcoat and his hat askew, a face of white whiskers, and when he sees Hardcore, he wants to move, get out the way, man, and his legs can't let him. Funny. Hardcore calls him, man, as he passes by. They got their knees, he thinks, wishing he told his boys that too. Everybody on these streets, man. These motherfuckers out here is just completely crazy with what they need. This gal, she need a check, and this mama be needing to hold her baby, and that old cat need his fix. Needing. He sometimes thinks he doesn't walk on pavement. He's just moving on top of what everybody needs. He crosses the boulevard, Grace Street, and starts down Lawrence, a block of ruined three-story apartment buildings, styled as battlements, with flat, tarred roofs and limestone blocks placed decoratively amid the dark bricks and as a board above the doorways and at the cornices. The windows are gone in some, boarded up. A raised garden area, railroad ties since under the windows of 338. The dirt, desert dry. Even the weeds struggling to survive. Yo! Lavinia calls, emerging like a cat from one of her hiding places. This Lavinia, he thinks. God, look at here, this scrawny bitch. Motherfucker, you gonna believe it? With this fuzzball stocking cap dragged down over her whole damn head and this gray coat and twill pants. Don't want nobody coming up on her to know she a bitch is what it is. Figure they'd shoot her ass or molest her ass or something. They better not try neither. She ain't strapped. Armed. She know better than that for when Tic Tac come by. But you bet she got it near here, under the mailbox, or in a hole in one of them trees. You mess with her, she gonna spook you ass. Word up. T-Rock, he think Hardcore Stone crazy using Bug, but she sharp. She strut up to the cars. She changed her whole routine now. She sort of swinging it a lot. What you like, man? Make 'em say. Anybody she take for Tic Tac, Narco, when they say, dope, she just go, oh, man, I ain't selling dope, man. I got something sweeter than that, man. Like she thinking they was here to bone. Now she points to the white Nova at the curb, 100 feet away. I done told her, lady, you in the wrong place. Lady? What kind of motherfucking lady? Told you now, 10-2. He ain't come. She come. She be looking for Ordell. Bug smiles then, toward the walk. Lavinia, just a kid and all, 15. She loved to play. Lady, Hardcore repeats a few more times. Damn. He advances on the car. Lady, this the wrong place for you. Leaning into the darkness of the car, he catches some of her soapy smell and the humid, sour scent of his own overheated breath. You best get out here fast.
Mr. Trent, I'm June Edgar.
She extends her hand and then laboriously leaves the car to stand in the bluish morning light. Oh, she be fat too, big and fat. Some kind of hippie or farmer or some such, and her thighs all mashed together in her jeans. She have a plain face and some long, lightish brown kind of hair going to gray, kind of lopsided and knit together like it ain't really combed.
I thought we could talk a minute.
Lady, there ain't nothing for you and me to talk about.
Well, I thought... I'm Niles' mother.
Told him to get himself here, didn't tell him to send nobody's mama.
I thought it was better if I came.
You better go, that's all. They some powerful shit may go down here. Word now gone. He steps away, flitting his hand.
Look, I know them both. I think there's a misunderstanding.
Only misunderstanding is you staying here instead of leaving out when I say go. That's the only misunderstanding we got.
I really think,
lady, you gonna get fucked up bad, you hear? Now jump in your rusty ass ride. He throws a hand again in disgust and walks away. Lavinia has stepped toward the street, waving.
Gorgo!
She calls, signaling overhead. Oh, fuck me, motherfuck, Hardcore says. From the alley across the way, Gorgo has emerged, tearing out on a sturdy black frame mountain bike. He has a mask on, a blue handkerchief across his face like he's some cowboy motherfucker. But looks otherwise like he just going home to mama, blue pack fixed on his back, red satin jacket, hat turned behind his ear, just a kid, if you don't notice the gat. The gun, held low by his side. A 9, got his Tech 9. The semi-automatic weapon, from his sheer weight, seems to drag behind as Gorgo rides. Bug keeps on waving, calling out as Gorgo rushes on, but he doesn't see her. He never will. Hardcore knows. You can see Gorgo's eyes at 60 feet now, popped out like some pipe is. Only with him, all it is panic.
I gotta do this, Gorgo's thinking. Gotta do this, man.
Hardcore knows. His whole self is shrunken down to a little pea of violent will, so there's no room for anything to tell him no. The gun is up, straight this way, and for 1 second, Ordell sees nothing of it but the small silver O and the frightening black space within it at the end of the muzzle.
Gorgo!
She calls again. And Hardcore, who has already dropped to the pavement, catches the hem of her coat and drags at it. Get your fool self down, he says. And she comes to him, easy as a leaf falling from a tree, just as the first shots bolt the air. Damn, guns always be louder than you expect. The reports come at once, 5 or 6 volleys, a rampage of sound, just that quick. Afterwards, it is the same as always, a moment of awful, cowering stillness. The birds gone from the trees, radios knocked silent, folks in the adjoining building stretched out flat along the cold floors, desperate not to stir. Caught up, the pointed scent of gunpowder embitters a sudden breath of wind. A block off, in some silly act of jubilation and relief, Gorgo cries out shrilly, and his voice trails down the distance like a ribbon.
Breathe, Ordell thinks. Breathe now, nigga.
He's amped. His heart is hard with panic.
You okay? He talks to himself. You not hurt? Stay cool, stay moving.
Then he sees the blood spread darkly on the sidewalk. He has been shot twice before, once when he was 16. That was some serious shit. Sort of giving face to some dude, and the mother pulled out a 38 and boom! Just like it was, but a little more down talk. Now he cool. He's checked his body twice, felt everything. He damn well knowed he was gonna get himself popped, and he didn't. But Lavinia has hold of her knee, and she is moaning.
Happening, bug?
She's crying. Tears well across her smooth face and curl in silvery traces about her mouth.
It hurt Hardcore. Man, it hurt real bad.
We're gonna help you, girlfriend.
He crawls closer to her. She's lying on her side with her knee drawn up halfway. Her hands are covered with blood and has turned most of the right leg of her twills brown. This close, he can detect the strange animal smell of it. He isn't gonna get her to move, he can see that. How'd she go get shot in the damn leg of all places? Ricochet or some such. Dude shot in the leg died too. He seen that. Severed femoral artery. Leg might be broke. There was no use shouting out for any of his people. Tiny gangsters of them. Soon as the guns rang out, they sprung. That Gorgo. I'm gonna fuck that motherfucker up bad. Gorgo was long gone. Between the buildings, up an alley, down one more gangway. Somewhere along, the Tech Nine went into the backpack. Now he's just some skinny kid out on his ride. Up above somewhere, a window screams as it's opened.
I hope all you goddamn gangbangers be dead, what I hope.
The woman's voice carries clearly in the thin morning.
I hope you dead. Look at what you all done.
Call emergency, bitch,
he shouts.
I already done that. Police coming. They gonna take your sorry ass down to the jail where it belong, hardcore.
At his name, he wheels, and the window is slammed too, that fast, before he can see. Lavinia is still moaning. Gonna help you, homegirl, he repeats. The white lady, he sees now, Niles' mama, she laying there too. There's just blood, blood, all over her head. Half her brownish hair gone, and she ain't moving none. Smoked, he thinks. He's seen dead before, and he knows it for sure. Bug is all gone to pieces. Some is like that. Them polices, tic-tacs, they done her like they do. Took her, handcuffed her arm over her head all day, walked by her smacking them nightsticks in their palms. She be tight, like it don't bother her none. But now she crying like a baby. She like something what got broke. She wasn't gonna hold. Now neither. Especially now. His daddy gonna be going on now, in his shit. When them tic-tacs start in with questions, wasn't nobody gonna ride this beef. Gonna be all fucked up. Police coming, he tells Bug. He gonna have to figure something. That damn woman know his name. Tic-tac be knocking on his door. Call the attorney. Call attorney Ayers, he thinks. Gonna have to look after himself. How it always be. He stands. The white Nova is messed up. The windows, except the one which was open, are shot through. Jagged pieces gone, and the remainder, a map of silver crazes. The tires on the side that face Gorgo's onslaught are flattened, causing the car to list. Through one of the steel window supports, there's a single bullet hole. The white paint burned gray about it. Damn him anyway, Hardcore thinks. Damn now, fuck everything up. Best give me that shit, girlfriend. You got trouble enough. She opens her mouth, but cries out as she turns herself to reach. Here? He asks, and slips his finger quickly between her tooth and gum to pull out the little foil packet. God damn, what are you gonna catch from her mouth anyway? This here just some damn drive-by, he tells her. You hear? Outlaws riding down. Police gonna be asking. That's what you say. Same as we done said, just Goobers riding down on you. He touches her cheek. She wasn't never gonna stand up to Tic Tac. Posse out, he says. Bye-bye.
P.O.,
she repeats. He hates it most when he has to run.
September 12th, 1995. Sunny. Her Honor, Judge Sonia Klonsky, enters her chambers, burdened with packages and the teeming, solitary feelings of the lunch hour, and finds two police officers in the outer office, usually occupied by her minute clerk, Marietta Raines. Both large men, the cops linger over a yellow legal pad, drafting an affidavit to support an arrest warrant. The white one, Lubitsch, is a self-conscious prototype, a bodybuilder who has turned himself into a human landscape, with mountainous shoulders and a neck like a tree stump. He has removed his sport jacket and seated himself at Marietta's desk. As he writes, his partner Wells makes sounds over Lubitsch's shoulder to show whether or not he agrees. Passing by, the judge glances at the face sheet of the warrant, which they have already completed for her approval. From the two brown paper sacks she carries, the aromas of a household arise. Bread and produce and cardboard, items gathered as she rushed store to store among the little Italian shops that persist on these depleted streets near the Kendall County Central Courthouse. Lunch is the most important hour of the day for Sunny, the only time she is without direct responsibilities to others. She must retrieve Nikki from daycare by 5 o'clock, and then begin the hours of feeding, bathing, talking, mothering, her truest labor in Sunny's mind. Now, with the bags still in her arms, she remains vaguely conscious of 6 summer nectarines she picked by hand, whose cool, flawless skin and sensuous cleft woke her unpredictably, comically, to some semblance of longing. The warrant is for one Delio Love, residing at apartment 9G, 5327 Grace Street, DuSable. On Saturday, September 10th, according to the warrant, defendant did commit the offense of deviant sexual assault against one Zunita Collins, aged 12, a minor, in that he engaged in the unconsented and offensive touching of said Zunita Collins's breasts, buttocks, and vagina. Wells points to the defendant's name. "Guess he's just love all the time," he says. A stout man, Wells smiles too broadly. He has dark venous gums and snaggle teeth. Lubitsch continues writing, which means he has heard the remark before. The last time Wells was in here, a month or two ago, he talked to Sonny at length about his son who was competing in the Special Olympics. But the crime, the projects, has brought something tougher to the surface. There are some cops who remind Sonny of her Uncle Moosh, in whose home she lived for extended periods throughout her childhood. Men who seem to be the calm center of the world, quietly and confidently sorting good from bad with the cheerful conviction that it is somehow worth the effort. But neither Wells nor Lubitsch is like that. For them, you can see that each case, each crime is personal, riling contentious feelings. In this, of course, they are more like Sunny than she would prefer. In her prior job as a prosecutor, an advocate, it seemed natural to feel this intense connection to every case, to the world's need to punish, to be for the victims and their right to receive whatever poor amends they could. Coming to the bench, she welcomed the prospect of more distance, but instead she frequently finds herself not merely touched by cases, but, in ways that puzzle her, still deeply involved. Occasionally she is gripped by the anguish of the victims, but most often, too often for comfort, it is the accused, the defendants, poor and always somehow wretched, who remind her in the most secret and fragmentary ways of herself. The judge lifts a hand to the cops, letting them resume work on their warrant. They are amiable regulars here, particularly welcome because few other persons around this courthouse seem to fully trust her. Most of the clerks, the deputies, the PAs, and judges regard Sunny as a foreigner, a former federal prosecutor who was one of a half dozen lawyers of established integrity recruited to the state court bench by a reform commission created in the wake of the latest bribery scandal, which enveloped 4 different courtrooms. Sunny suspects that after only 2 years on the bench, she is regarded by her colleagues as unqualified to be sitting on felonies, a plum and demanding assignment. Certainly, she is unwanted here amid people who have been entrusted with each other's secrets for years. In the interior office of the chambers, the deputy sheriff assigned to the courtroom, Annie Chung, is arranging the array of multicolored paperwork that resulted from the tumultuous status call which Sunny holds each Tuesday morning. At the sight of the judge, Annie rises to relieve her of her packages, taking an instant to peer discreetly into one. Annie has begun night classes at college. She dreams of law school. And, Sunny is sure, envisions herself someday in the flowing black raiment of a judge, on the bench, empowered and obeyed. To these hopes there is a heart-sore quality, since Annie a few months ago married a sleek, wealthy boy from Hong Kong, far more traditional than she is. At times, Sunny sees Annie staring at the wedding and engagement rings on her left hand, admiring them in the light, but with the startled, immobilized air of some discontent she cannot yet name. "Reporters called," Annie says. "What about?" "You got a new case, up for initial appearance at 2 o'clock, Odell Trent, a.k.a. Hardcore." She has a distinct Chinese accent that softens the R's to the point that they are indistinct. Odell, Hardcore. "Murder in the first degree." You caught that one, Judge? Lubitsch has come to absorb the light in the doorway. We had that goof in the station this morning. Big time saint. That's the one I was telling you about? He is speaking to Wells. Where we got to get over to General? Judge, that case is a doozy. Sunny shakes her head. Her dark hair is abundant, and, as has been the case since college, is worn free to her shoulders. There is now more than a little gray, which in this job is thought to add distinction. Fred, come on, don't backdoor me. I'll hear it from the PA in court. Yeah, okay, he says. But it's a doozy. It's a doozy, Sonny says, and restrains, in the name of Amity, a motion to Annie to close the door. She has taken her chair behind an enormous mahogany desk, which, with its tiered edges, reminds her of a steamship. From the tall, old, mullioned windows behind her, a grand view of the back reaches of DuSable City recedes. On her desk is a lucite gavel, 3 feet long, given to her by her colleagues when she left the United States Attorney's Office. In jest, they had it inscribed, Ms. Justice Klonsky. There are also pictures of 2 children, her daughter Nikki, almost 6, and Sam, a knock-kneed boy past 12, whom she helped raise during the year she was married to his father. Sonny left that man, Charlie, almost 3 years ago. It was on the radio last week, says Annie. Those damn gangbangers or something, some kind of drive-by shooting, and this lady got in the way, a white lady. White? Says Sonny. Where in the world did this happen? Annie reads from the complaint in the court file, prepared by the PAs in felony review, 6:30 a.m. September 7. Grace Street again. What was she doing at Grace Street? Sonny asks. Maybe she's with probation, children's services, something like that. At that hour? Sonny motions for the complaint. Reminded, she calls out to the officers to be sure they notified children's services about Zunita Collins. Already got her, Lubitsch answers. Got who? Asks Marietta, coming through the door. Returning from lunch, she is still wearing sunglasses and carries a package of her own. Without a word, the 2 cops rise at once to make way. Marietta Raines is proprietary about every aspect of this courtroom, where she has been the clerk and procedural ruler for almost 2 decades. She throws her purse and packages inside her desk and immediately reads the pages the officers have drawn for the judge's approval. Lord, says Marietta, shaking her head over Zunita Collins. I don't want to hear about nobody had a better weekend than me. In a heavy-footed way, Marietta moves into the inner chambers, feigning to remain oblique to the dark look the judge has passed her. With rarely a rearward glance, Marietta throws the inner door closed on the 2 cops still howling over her remark. She has on a long, bunchy cotton skirt, summer wear that will outlast the season in this overheated building. Despite their 9 months together, Sonny is still not certain whether the woolly afro Marietta wears is a wig. Rather than further confront her clerk, always a challenge, the judge returns to the murder complaint Annie handed her, the one naming the gangbanger Hardcore. Oh my God, says Sonny. My God, June Edgar? I know June Edgar. She's the one who was killed? My God. Her son's a probation officer, isn't he? Niall Edgar? Remember when he was in here, I told you I knew his family? Marietta, already familiar with the murder case, nods and with a flawless memory recalls the matter on which Niall appeared last May. Niall, as Sonny remembers that appearance, was tall and poorly groomed. He wore a funky goatee and was far too fidgety to meet her eye. He gave no sign he might have any memory of her from so long ago. Oh, God, Sonny says again. June Edgar. Do I have to disqualify myself? What for? Asks Marietta. She your girlfriend or something? How'd you know her in the first place, Judge? You all from the same neighborhood? No, it was in California. We lived in the same apartment building with the Edgars, my boyfriend and I. He used to babysit for Niall. This is years ago, 20 at least. More. God, what a weird coincidence. She shivers somewhat. It always takes her an instant to recognize what has gripped her so fiercely. Death. Dying. A dozen years ago, she had cancer of the breast, and anything that whispers about her own mortality can seize her with panic. Niall's father's here, isn't he? In the state legislature, is that right? State senator. Marietta, who is beholden to her councilman for her job, goes to all the dinners, knows every party figure. District 39, Far Kindle, Greenwood Counties. Some kind of college professor, seemed like, and he got some funny name. Loyal Edgar, says Sonny, and all three women laugh. Names around here are a never-ending subject. African names, Hispanic names, gang names, aliases by the dozen. People just call him Edgar. At least they used to. I think he was teaching at Easton at one point. That's how he ended up back here. He'd gone there before. When I knew him in California, he was a Maoist. God, those were crazy times, adds Sonny, and for a moment is held by the turmoil, the conflict of those years. It seems so far away, and yet, like so much of life, underlies everything she is doing, like the soil from which all that's planted blooms. And now he's a state senator. Wow, is what she wants to say. Lexicon of that bygone era. Wow. There have been some changes in her lifetime. I think June and he split up a long time ago, Sonny adds. As far as I knew, she didn't even live around here. The details have not really stuck. Her mind is porous when it comes to gossip. She will often make terrible gaffes. And which boyfriend is it you was living with? Asks Marietta. The one who writes the column now? Yet another dark look passes from the judge to her clerk, a plump, brown woman of middle years who, as ever, makes a determined effort to pay no mind. Within the chambers, when there are no outsiders, there is an odd intimacy among the three women, especially when the conversation turns away from the law to home, men, children, the female realm with its mysterious equality. Yet Marietta knows no proper bounds. The way she puts it, as if Sonny had submitted a curriculum vitae of her love life. 1969 to 1970, Seth Weissman, a.k.a. Michael Frayn. 1970 to 1972, various gentlemen of the Philippines. 1972 to 1975, long dry spell. 1977 to 1992, Charles Brace. In truth, this is information that Marietta has cobbled together with her own insistent curiosity, which Sonny always feels somewhat powerless to turn aside. Marietta has a husband of sorts, Raymond, but they have their troubles. For Marietta, therefore, this is the question of her life. What happens to love? What guy who writes the column? Annie asks. Now, haven't you heard that? Judge here used to live with that fella. What's his name, Judge? Marietta, that was in the dark ages. I was a child. But the usual look of appreciation for Sonny's accomplishments has already come across Annie's tiny face. He's in the Tribune, Marietta says. How'd you call it? What he writes, Judge? Lifestyle, I suppose. The 60s survivor point of view. Right. You know how funny people can be and what they do. I think the column is called The Survivor's Guide. Michael Frayn, says Sonny. He writes under the name of Michael Frayn. He's syndicated, she adds, and then feels that she's fallen into Marietta's trap and is actually boasting about this boy who came and went from her life before Noah set to sea. Oh, I read that, says Annie. He made me laugh. He was your boyfriend? Momentarily, but his name isn't really Michael Frayn. It's Seth Weissman. Michael Frayn is a pen name. The whole thing is somewhat confusing. We knew somebody named Michael Frayn at that point. He lived in the building, too. With Niall Edgar in them? Right. Niall and Edgar and June in one apartment, Seth and me in another, and then Michael Frayn. Other people, too, obviously. Sounds like some commune, says Marietta. And Sonny cannot contain herself. She laughs aloud. Sometimes Marietta might just as well say it. You white folks are strictly crazy. Yet there was some aspect of happy communalism in those years. Young, before the walls were up, the boundaries drawn. Seth's best friend, who was in law school, was always in their apartment. Hobie something, a big, funny guy, black, a wild character. Annie has looked up from the files and studies the judge, trying to comprehend all of this, the names, the relations. She has delicate looks, her eyes smallish against a broad flange of cheek. Sunny repeats herself. Michael wasn't my boyfriend. My boyfriend's name was Seth. He's the one who writes the column, but the pen name he uses is Michael Frayn. Marietta, with a big city look of mistrust, finally speaks the lingering question. So what happened to Michael Frayn? I haven't the foggiest, says Sunny. God's truth. Seth and I were past tense by then. Not that she hasn't wondered. A sudden stab of curiosity sometimes reaches her when she sees the name, the picture at the heading of the column. How did Seth become Michael? Where did Michael go? The questions, even now, make her uneasy. This talk of Seth, of newspapers, brings Sunny's mind again to June Edgar and the murder. There will be reporters in the courtroom. A white lady murdered in a drive-by, mother of a probation officer, a prominent politician's ex. Lubitsch is right. It's a doozy. I'd love to keep this case, she says to Marietta. It's not really the attention that excites her. Since all new judges face a yes-no retention vote 6 years after appointment, the accepted wisdom is to avoid publicity so that the voters will have no reason to reject you. It's more the past that seems somehow alluring. The unexcavated remains of her own existence. Something back there, perhaps merely her youth, inspires curiosity. The vaguest thrill to think of the distances she's moved. Keep it, Marietta answers. Chief Judge don't like you to transfer cases anyway. The judges, lawyers, Pauls, bureaucrats by training, are often schemers, inclined to dump demanding or controversial cases on colleagues with less clout. As a result, the chief, Brendan Toohey, has erected strict rules. The mere thought of Toohey and his edicts makes Sunny uneasy. Raised without a father at home, she inevitably finds men of a certain age formidable. And Toohey, a crafty Paul whose probity has long been open to question, has never cared for Sunny or the reform commission that forced her into his domain. To her face, he is unfailingly polite, even courtly. But Sandy Stern, Sunny's old friend and occasional mentor, has gone so far as to suggest that Toohey placed her in the criminal division in spite of her limited judicial experience, a year in the matrimonial division, a few months in the criminal branch courts, in the hope she would fail. Well, I have to put something on the record about knowing June. When's this case up for the bond hearing, now? It's nearly 2 o'clock. There will be no bail, of course. The gang defendants are invariably on probation or parole, and bond, under the law, is not permitted. Sunny asks about Hardcore's probation status, and Annie sets off to the outer office to get the answer from Marietta's computer console. Marietta continues racking the files from the morning call on a stainless steel cart for transport back to the clerk's office. Hardcore has himself a probation officer. Lubitsch, having thrown open the door a bit too forcefully, is on the threshold with Annie beside him. Beaming, virtually luminous with secret knowledge, the policeman engages in a stage pause until Sunny beckons with a hand. Niall Edgar, says Lubitsch. He's Hardcore's probation officer. In the corridor outside, between the chambers and the courtrooms, somebody important enough to be disdainful of the peace happens by whistling. This gangbanger killed his probation officer's mother in a drive-by? Sunny asks. That's a coincidence? That's no coincidence, and no drive-by. Maybe the saints want to make it look that way. This was a contract killing. The portent of this is bad. A street gang taking deliberate aim on a probation officer's family. A new battlefront opened in the war on the streets. Want to know the rest? Asks Lubitsch, still glowing. I'll hear it in court, Fred. I'm going to do your warrant after my motions. Whatever you say, Judge, he answers, but cannot restrain one more disbelieving toss of his head. He says yet again, it's a doozy. Sunny grabs the black robe from the coat tree behind her desk and zips it halfway. With a certain processional formality, Marietta and Annie hasten before her down the hall into the courtroom. A double doozy. Everyone will want a piece of this case. The mayor will be on TV, sticking up for law enforcement. An atmosphere of brooding anger will penetrate the courtroom. Sunny, who has not yet endured the storm of a controversial case, becomes conscious somewhere at her center of the troubled qualms of fear. In the corridor, Marietta's fine alto arrives, so round with pride you would think it's her own name she is singing out. "The Honorable Sonia Klonsky," she can be heard crying. "Judge presiding." 2 p.m. bond call. Black men in manacles. The chief judge, Brendan Toohey, sets bail according to a pre-established scale on all cases on which the grand jury returns an indictment. But under state law, when a defendant is arrested on the basis of a prosecutor's complaint, he is entitled to a bond hearing before the assigned trial judge. Sunny regards it as one of her saddest duties to deliver the crushing news most of these young men receive, that their liberty, like some item checked at the door, is lost and unlikely soon to be retrieved. April, Elliot said, is the cruelest month. But if he was looking for the cruelest place, he should have come here, to the Superior Court of Kendall County. A kind of barbarity seems to blow in with the defendants from the bad neighborhoods and mean streets, a grim devastation, a slaughterhouse reek. Here are freely traded the secrets no one wants to hear. At one point last month, there were 4 different trials ongoing involving mothers or fathers who had murdered their children. This morning, Sonny arraigned 6 gang members who surrounded a recalcitrant 12-year-old in a housing project stairwell and beat him with a pipe until the brain matter was literally oozing from his skull. These tales of astonishing brutality, of stabbings and rapes, of shootings and stick-ups, of the inevitable crime of the day, so heinous that, like certain forms of pornography, it seems beyond normal imagining. These are routine, 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 and their meanness is matched only by the system of which she is standard-bearer and emblem, whose clandestine rationale too often seems to Sunny to be to capture, judge, and warehouse the very poor. Every month or so, preparing for a status call, she will go back to the lockup, looking for Annie or the transport deputy, and confront, through the bars, the day's load of prisoners, 12 or 14 young men. You would expect them to rise up in revolt, but most are quiet, shifting about, smoking their cigarettes. If they dare to look her way at all, it is without defiance, or often hope. They have been humiliated, tamed. On the bench, though, sorrow is seldom the predominant emotion. In this atmosphere of loathing and fear, she labors on, trying to impose reason where, generally speaking, impulse and emotion have held sway. Murder is the marquee business of this courtroom. Gangbangers killing gangbangers. Men killing men. They use guns mostly. Also knives, bats, razor blades, automobiles, crowbars, and in one celebrated case, an anvil. The young people kill each other for reasons that are often incomprehensible. Because somebody was signifying on the wrong corner. Because a jacket was torn. In 9 months, she has mastered all the terminology. Ride-by, shooting on the move. Drive-up, firing from a stop. Drive-through, the car is the weapon. Chase-aways, the enemy flees. The older folks also live in a world from which anger and desperation emanate as tangible as heat. Yes, men still kill each other over dice games, drugs, and, naturally, who was coveting whose girl. What can you say about a loaded gun in the hand of a spurned and drunken man? On the streets, unrequited love and death go together almost as often as in Shakespeare. Now the courtroom lingers in the somnolent air of the afternoon. This morning, during the weekly status call, the courtroom and corridor teemed with all the urgent antagonists. The defense lawyers, the cops and prosecutors, the aggravated citizen witnesses, the deputies sullenly transporting the defendants, and those defendants' beleaguered, woebegone women. But now, there is a melancholy stillness. Outside the open doors at the rear of the courtroom, a custodian mops the halls in the yellowing light. Marietta hammers the gavel sharply, and the lawyers and reporters and sheriff's deputies slowly gather themselves to their feet, as Sunny climbs up the four stairs beside the bench, a clean-lined oak affair of faux Bauhaus design. The senior judges sit in stately palaces in the main building on the third and fourth floors, vast chambers that bespeak the same architectural strategies as cathedrals, the individual dwarfed by the majesty of marble columns and gilt-framed portraiture, by the rococo gigaws of carved walnut and ceilings vaulting 2.5 stories above. These courtrooms, in the central courthouse annex, were built in the 80s, when D.C. poured what money there was into law enforcement. The room strikes a clanging note of late-century efficiency, bang for the buck. For Sunny, the courtroom feels as intimate as her living room, but like certain children, its glory is not obvious to outsiders. It is a pie-shaped room, broadening back from the bench, rickety public construction, the plasterboard gouged in places, the meal-colored carpet already tearing away in hairy chunks. The jury box and witness stand repeat the stark lines of the bench. Weirdest is the track lighting, reminiscent of a motel lounge, which is positioned over the major players, judge, witness, attorneys, leaving dim spots throughout the windowless courtroom where the lawyers, the bailiff, the clerks tend to retreat in relaxed instants, like actors off stage. In the wake of the shooting death of a matrimonial court judge several years ago, these courtrooms have been built with a wall of bulletproof glass in front of the spectators' sections. The sound of justice being done is piped back there by way of microphones, which seem to pick up the heavy breath of everyone, defendants, lawyers, Sunny herself, in the intervals between words. She looks out there every day toward the friends, the relatives edging forward on their seats to catch some sight, some news about their loved one in jail overalls. In warning to them, Marietta has taped a hand-lettered sign to their side of the glass. No eating, no drinking, no visiting in the lockup or the courtroom. Now the dozen reporters who are present resume the leather barrel chairs in the jury box, where they have placed themselves to ensure that they can hear. The amplification system to the region beyond the glass often conks out, and the angled walls make the acoustics unpredictable. The journalists are mostly the hangdog beat reporters, but two of the pretty faces of local TV are present. Stanley Rosenberg, the little ferret from Channel 5 in a $500 blazer, and ratty blue jeans that the camera will not see, scurries to a seat next to a sketch artist he has brought along. In this courthouse, where the judges are elected, the press is inevitably accommodated, especially in the afternoon, when the reporters are all on deadline. Marietta calls first the case about the murder of June Edgar. People versus Ordell Trent. From the lockup, the defendant, a.k.a. Hardcore, is brought into the courtroom in his blue jumpsuit, handcuffs, and ankle chains. With mild alarm, Sonny recognizes the lawyer who comes to stand beside him, Jackson Ayers. Ayers has fought these wars so long he comes up firing out of instinct, one of those guys who talk the trash he knows his clients want to hear, albeit in a somewhat inanimate fashion, with no real body language to his lament. A worn-out-looking black man of mid-tone complexion with a pomp of age-whitened African hair, Ayers wears an old burgundy sport coat and scuffed bucks. With reporters here, he will put on a hell of a show, demanding bail for his client. The lawyers state their names, and Sunny makes her record. She knew the Edgar family 25 years ago, but has had no contact with any of them since, save Niall Edgar, who may have appeared as a probation officer in this courtroom once. Tommy Molto, deputy supervisor in homicide, a smallish, dumpy-looking lifer who rose close to the top of the PA's office a few administrations back, only to slide back down in the shadow of some disremembered scandal, has appeared for the state, filling in on the initial appearance. Mr. Ayers or Mr. Molto, if either of you feels the slightest reservation, I'll be happy to return this case to the chief judge for reassignment. Ayers just shakes his head. No problem, Judge. Molto repeats the same words. She knew the prosecuting attorney's office would have no objection. They have 106 cases in this courtroom. They will have between 98 and 112 cases on her docket every day of the year. They are not about to question her impartiality. Not on the record. The only cavil she will hear, if there is one, will come in the corridors through the grapevine. Sonny recites the charges in the complaint. Hardcore looks on alertly. The defendants are usually phased or anxious, lost to arcana of the courtroom. But Hardcore, burly, dark, with thick eyes, maintains himself with dignity. He knows what is occurring. Innocently, as if she did not know she was sounding a battle alarm, Sonny asks, "Mr. Ayers, do you have a motion?" Long-limbed, still-lithe appearing, Jackson Ayers uncrosses his arms and edges closer to his microphone that angles up from the oak podium before the bench. To Jackson Ayers, the criminal law really has no categories, only colors, white and black. He can play the game, talk your talk, cite the precedents, but with no evident belief they control or even contribute to the result. To him, every rule, every procedure is simply one more device to delay, by other means, the emancipation of the slaves. Now he looks disconsolately at the rug. "No motion, Judge." There is a decided change, a pulse in the atmosphere. The two lawyers look up at her like collared hounds, hoping for understanding. They wish to say no more in front of the reporters, many of whom nonetheless seem to have gleaned the significance of Ayers' remark. Stanley Rosenberg, Sonny notes, has slipped over two seats towards Stu Dubinsky from the Tribune. Stanley's smooth coiffure holds a spot of courtroom light as he bobs his head, absorbing Dubinsky's interpretation. "Perhaps counsel should approach," says Sonny. She waves away Suzanne, the court reporter, and meets the lawyers, remaining on the lowest step beside the bench. "What's the deal?" she whispers. "I take it the defendant has made an arrangement with the people?" Ayers looks to Multo. Multo says, "That's correct, Judge. We've worked something out, if the court approves." His Adam's apple does a turn beneath the second chin. He is badly pockmarked. "We're still checking the details, Judge," Multo whispers. "There's a lot to investigate, but if the defendant's story holds, we've agreed to 20 years, Judge." "On the shooter?" She has raised her voice more than she would like. With day-for-day good time, Hardcore will be out of the penitentiary in a decade. On this case, with a sheet, he's only doing 10 inside? "He's not the trigger, Judge, and he's giving us someone else. He was just the broker, Mr. Ayers' client. There was someone else who got him to do it." "The mayor?" The two lawyers both laugh, a peculiar outbreak of sound in the courtroom where everyone else is silent in hopes of getting an idea of what is transpiring beside the bench. When she became a judge, Sonny found she had grown much funnier. In the interval, she ponders what Multo is saying. Hardcore has flipped, turned state's evidence, which the gangbangers seldom do. It's an interesting development. "Look," she says, "when you can talk about the case, you call me. This is going to require some discussion." Sonny is visited by her recurring suspicion. They are setting her up. Somebody is. The cops, the prosecutors, the Chief Judge Brendan Toohey. They are hoping she'll make a noteworthy mistake so they can run her out of the building. She gathers her robes, ready again to ascend, then thinks to ask if Multo plans to indict Hardcore and his co-defendant together. Multo nods. It will be her case. She will preside at trial, if the threat of Hardcore's testimony does not persuade whoever engineered the murder to plead guilty. Multo speaks up to detain her. "Judge," he says. His voice has dropped to the very edge of audibility. Even his lips are self-consciously stiffened to defeat the most intrepid of the reporters. "Judge, just so you know, it's Niall Edgar. It's no problem for the people. But so you know, given what you said." An empty second passes among the three. "Wait." She's come down the last stair. "Wait. I'm playing catch-up. Let's not be cryptic, Tommy. You're telling me Mr. Ayers' client, whatever, Hardcore, that he's going to testify that his probation officer, Niall Edgar, conspired with him to plan this killing of Mr. Edgar's mother?" Malto looks at length across his shoulder to the reporters before he answers. "More or less," he says. The two lawyers face her without expression, awaiting whatever will come next. Sonny labors an instant with the turmoil. We haven't picked him up yet, Molto says. We'll probably get a warrant tomorrow. It's a secret, he's telling her. She nods two or three times, numbed. After the call, she finds Wells and Lubitsch loitering in the inner office. They've placed the draft on her desk, but Lubitsch winds his head back around toward the courtroom as soon as she appears. Average American family, right? He asks her. Apple pie, hot dogs, and Chevrolet, right? This gloating, the usual cop smugness, us and them, is rankling to Sonny. Only yesterday, Fred Lubitsch would have called Niall a player on his side. With a bare inspection, she signs the warrant and lets the officers go. Marietta slinks in about an hour later, having wheeled the morning files across to the main building. She is curious, naturally, about the goings-on at Sidebar and utters a startled, dyspeptic groan upon learning of Molto's news about Niall, but shows little other emotion. Marietta has been around. Should I take myself off the case now? Sonny asks. 'Cause you knew these folks 25 years ago? Hell, who they gonna give the case to, Judge? Everybody else sitting in the criminal division knows Niall Edgar better than you now. You're the junior here, Judge. The other judges? They've all had Niall before them a bunch of times, worked with him, believed his testimony under oath. We've only had him in here but once. And plenty of these judges know the father, too. He ran for controller a couple years back, didn't he? He was at all the dinners. Sides, Judge, a case like this, nobody's gonna be happy to see it turn up on their calendar. Race, that's what she means. The great unmentionable.